Can you imagine life without Google Search, Google Maps, or Gmail? This hour, Stephen Levy joins us to talk about how Google went from being the dorm room project of a couple of Stanford grad students to the Goliath of the internet it is today, learning what you like and how you think every time you search. But what's next for the search giant? Congress wants to know, and is Facebook a threat? Plus, researchers are looking in weird places for the next big thing in biofuels, in the poop of pandas, zebras, and giraffes. Those animals can break down tough plant fibers and turn them into energy. Can they help us do the same? All that and the video pick, watching an algae water cleaner. Coming up after this break, so stay with us.
This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to squarespace.com and enter the coupon code SCIENCEFRIDAY9.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I'll bet that you have a Gmail account, right? And you turn to Google Maps when you need to find your way to someplace new. Maybe you have an Android phone. Well, how did these products become such an indispensable part of our lives? How did two Stanford PhD dropouts build a company that touches everything we do online? My next guest, tech writer Stephen Levy, has been covering Google for over a decade, from way back in the early days when they were operating out of an office above a bicycle shop just off the Stanford campus. And in his new book, In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives, he gives us a sort of biography of the company and its founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. And inside, he gives us a look at how Google grew so quickly from small startup to internet giant with tens of thousands of employees, gobbling up companies like YouTube and Motorola for billions along the way. But can Google hold on to its empire? Or could Facebook be coming up next? Are the recommendations of your friends more important to you than the suggestions an algorithm spits out? Maybe you're already using Google's experiment in social media, Google+. We want to know what you think about Google. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Stephen Levy is author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. He's also senior writer at Wired here in New York, and he's in our New York studios. Good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
In the Plex, having the title has something to do with Google Plex in the old...
Yeah. The name of their campus is the Googleplex, and it's all a pun. It's a company that likes to have their fun. And the name Google comes from a mathematical term, which is a one followed by 100 zeros, a big number. And they deal in big data. That represents it. And I also misspelled it in part because it's fun to have those double O's that the original word doesn't have, and in part because they didn't get the domain name with the original spelling.
They didn't. Take us back to the late 90s. How did all of this get started?
So we have the internet. People thought that they searched it pretty good with the tools they had. There was a search engine called AltaVista, which everyone was impressed with. But Larry Page, a Stanford graduate student, as you mentioned, thought there might be a better way to do it. He came from an academic family, and he knew that one way to measure the popularity of academic articles was how many footnotes they had. And the World Wide Web had this tool that gave you a better way to search, which was these links. But in order to do that really well, you'd have to capture the entire World Wide Web on your computers. And he convinced his professors at Stanford to let him do that. And his buddy, Sergey Brin, another graduate student, did some of the mathematics that helped them interpret that. And lo and behold, they found by seeing what people link to on the web, they could get better search results. And that's what they did. They tried to sell it to the other search companies, but those search companies were attached to these things called portals, which saw themselves as destination sites that people would come to. And they turned them away. They said, we don't want to buy this technology because it's too good. People would search for things and they'd leave our website and they wouldn't look at our headlines or our finance product or whatever. So get out of here. We don't want search that's that good. And what could they do but start a company?
So they started their, own company. Did they think that this was a money-making project? That's what they were going to do.
Well, they felt that there was money to be made. They weren't 100% certain how it would be made. They thought, well, ads might be one way, but they had a problem with that because they hated advertising and wanted to figure out a new way to do advertising that wasn't intrusive, that users wouldn't blanch when they saw it. And they thought maybe we'll license it to some other companies and maybe we'll sell the technology to corporations that want to search within their own private internets, their intranets. And it was a problem for a while. The people who funded them, they got a lot of venture capital money at the end of the boom. And then harder times came to Silicon Valley, and the venture capitalists began getting a little nervous, saying, where's the money, guys? They were getting a lot of users. And then they invented a new ad product, which turned out to be exactly what satisfied their standard for what advertising should be. They felt the advertising should be as useful to the user as the search results. And they came up with an amazing formula that let them do that. And it turned out to be the most successful advertising product in the history of the internet, probably the most successful product in this century so far.
No kidding. And they keep secret these advertising formulas and their Google search formulas, things like that.
They keep a lot of secrets, but they've been a little more open. They don't like it when you call them black boxes. And I sat down with them. I spent a lot of time with all the search engineers and the ad engineers so I could explain to people how this stuff works. And as it turns out, if you learn how search works, if you learn how Google Ad works, you learn a lot about how Google thinks.
And how does a search work? Give us an idea what goes into a search.
So we talked a little bit about the basic ingredient of Google search originally, why it was so good, because
right.
It used these links. So if you figure it, if on my website, I like the Philadelphia Phillies, and if I put the Philadelphia Phillies in something that I'm writing on my blog or something like that, and it's underlined like a link, that's called anchor text, the place that I'm going to link it to probably is the homepage of the Philadelphia Phillies. And if other people do that, and if important sites, much more important than my blog, like the New York Times does that, that's an amazing way to tell that this is the most important important location for that term. And they could figure this out because they analyzed all these links on the web there. So that was the first thing. It was sort of a crowdsourced way to know what's important. And the name of that technology was called PageRank, not on web pages, but Larry Page, the Stanford
student.
That right? That's right. But as Google evolved, that PageRank was still an important component, but less crucial. It actually became sort of an artificial intelligence learning machine because Google got a lot of data from the way people searched, and they watched the way people behaved on the search engine, and they learned which searches were more effective, which locations satisfied which kinds of searches. It even learned about the language. If someone searched for a dog and didn't like what they liked, didn't like what they found, they might then type in puppy. And the search engine, enough people did that, figured dog, puppy, that's kind of alike.
So sort of artificial intelligence that's going on there.
Yeah, it's sort of like one of the science fiction things where you sort of like grow an intelligence in a big jar or something like that. Their search engine got to know things. And it learned more and more things and, you know, could even learn how to translate one language from another just by watching the way people operated and making use of the massive amounts of data available to Google. So as things go on, it really is something that learns by people search. And the more people search, the better it learned. And it was a real virtuous cycle.
You have spanned many of the greatest minds in Silicon Valley, Steve Jobs and Larry Page and Sergey. And in your book, you talk about how Steve Jobs tried to mentor both Page and Brin, but their relationship changed when Google came out with an Android phone.
That's right.
Happened there?
Yeah, for a while, it looked like, Steve Jobs and Sergey is like Humphrey Bogart and Claude Rains, a beautiful friendship. And Steve was impressed by them, and he was especially impressed because this is a partnership he could have, mainly to square off against Microsoft and other competitors, where they were entirely complementary. He figured he wasn't going to build the search engine, and they weren't going to build a phone. And then Google said, well, we bought this company called Android, but it really isn't going to be what the kind of stuff that you do. But then Steve came out with the iPhone, and Google realized that we better shelve the rather rudimentary phone that we're working on first and go to our future phone. And that looked a lot like the iPhone, behaved a lot like the iPhone. And when Steve got wind of that, he felt personally betrayed, and he got very angry.
There's a falling out between them?
It definitely was.
Mm-hmm. Would you consider he to be the new Steve Jobs? Would the Google be the new Apple on the block here?
Yeah, there are some aspects that are similar. Larry Page, who's the CEO now of Google, he was the original CEO. And then after much pressure from the venture capitalists who wanted, quote, adult supervision, they brought in someone. First, they wanted Steve Jobs. They thought that was the only guy that they would accept as a CEO, and that wasn't going to happen.
No.
But they settled on Eric Schmidt, who they liked because he was an engineer. He'd been to Burning Man, which was, an event that both Larry and Sergey had attended, and it showed something about him. And for 10 years, Eric did an excellent job of building it from a small company to a bigger company, but now Larry came back. And I think there's some aspects, just in terms of being driven and determined and ambitious and product-oriented, that are similar to Steve. He does not have Steve Jobs' personal charisma. You won't see him, doing keynotes and saying, there's one more thing, and then here's the next Google project.
So he's not going to fill a void as Steve leaves the stage now in public life.
I think that Steve is unique, and I think that in his own way, people like Larry, and you look at other people coming up, Jack Dorsey, who's an important person at Twitter and Square, the payment thing that the people saying there's a lot of extraordinary people out there, but only one Steve Jobs.
1-800-999-8255. Talking with Stephen Levy, author of In the Plex: How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. If I remember correctly, you also were an author of Insanely Great.
That is true. Yes,
that's. How do you get access to Steve Jobs, to all these great pioneers, and did they just let you in the door?
Well, I've been doing this for a while, so I kind of got in before the some of those guys were famous, and then I talked to the Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, and then these other people figured, God, I guess he knows Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. We have to talk to him too.
Were they easy to talk to, these guys from Google, or are they in a different world than you were?
I think they were easier to spend time with in the earlier days. When I signed up to do the book, they let me get a great access to the company, and Larry and Sergey and Eric all had to sign off on it because I got amazing access. I got to talk to virtually any person in the company. I got access to products while they were being developed. I got to sit in on some amazing meetings, like the search launch meeting, where they talk about what changes they're going to make to the search engine. Even though I'd run into Larry and Sergey quite often, I really had to push to get these long sit-down interviews that were so useful to me.
Now we'll talk more with Stephen Levy, author of In the Plex. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Talk about Google. We'll also talk about does Facebook represent a challenge that they should worry about? What about all these other things Google's getting into with voice and the Google Groups now, Google Plus? I mean, are you a Google Plus member? Do you like it? Does it work as well for you? Are you willing to trade off your friends in Facebook? Are they more worthwhile than a good search engine? Some questions and answers coming up after this break. Stay with us.
This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. With Squarespace, you can create a website that's uniquely you, write a blog you've been thinking about, display photos from Flickr, or connect website visitors to your pages on Facebook or Twitter. Choose from hundreds of design templates to get started, plus mobile apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android to update your site on the go. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, you say it easily and with style with Squarespace. Here's a special SciFry offer. Go to squarespace.com, sign up for a free account, then use the offer code SCIENCEFRIDAY9 for 10% off for 6 months if you decide to purchase. That's squarespace.com, offer code SCIENCEFRIDAY9. If you're a SciFry listener who uses Squarespace, please let us know. Post a link on our Facebook wall at facebook.com/SciFry. Thank you, Squarespace, for your support of Science Friday.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Google, a company many of us probably couldn't go a day without, at least for searching. Have you tried not using Gmail or Google search for a day or two? Where's the company going, though? What's it up to? We're here to talk about it, and fill us in is Stephen Levy. He's author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. He's also a senior writer at Wired here in New York. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Google seems to be just growing horizontally. Is that a good thing? I mean, are they going to take on Facebook and become a social community like they're trying with Google Plus?
Well, they figured out after several products that really didn't work so well in the social world, that they couldn't fool around. They absolutely had to have a big, successful social product because Facebook was getting all this amazing information about people that people voluntarily gave to Facebook, who their friends are, what they're interested in, what their activities are. And Google's mission is to access all the world's information and organize it. And this was really important information. If Google knew what you liked, they can give you better search results. They could do all sorts of things, show you better ads. And, you know, and so they figured we have to do this because if Facebook builds this information sphere that we can't get hold of, maybe they could do a search engine next. Who knows what they could do? So they put together a huge effort, one of the biggest ones in their history. There was codenamed Emerald Sea. Originally, they thought they'd get it out in 100 days, but it was more ambitious. It took longer. And eventually, they did put it out a couple months ago in what they call a field test. But what we're seeing now, you know, it has a couple pretty innovative things, like one thing called Circles that enables you to determine what you share and who you share it with a little more easily than you can with Facebook. But more is going to come online. Eventually, all of Google will be more social, and that's part of this wider experiment they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Microsoft bought Skype so that we can have voice things going on. Google has its own.
Right. Yeah, Google had an opportunity to buy Skype. I tell a story in the book how the guy in charge of the Google product, which is sort of a competitor to Skype, Google Voice, didn't like the idea that Google was going to buy Skype. So he actually planted a trap in a big meeting. He got Sergey on his side and another powerful person at Google, a guy named Salar, who's now the CEO of YouTube. And they basically went into the meeting pretending they liked the idea. But halfway through the meeting, they started asking all these questions. What about this? What about that? Isn't the government going to, you know, hold us up for a year before we do this? Who's going to go out to Europe to supervise these people? And by the end of it, the deal was off. So Google did not buy Skype. And, you know, this other company bought it from eBay and then sold it to Microsoft there.
So you think there's going to be a battle in that arena, too? Google's girding for a battle there in the voice?
Oh, definitely.
Telephony sort of thing?
Definitely.
Video?
Well, now they have, you know, they're buying Motorola. My suspicion is that eventually they're going to buy a network.
TV network?
No, a broadband network.
Oh, the whole like Comcast or something?
Yeah. So if you remember, a few years ago, they were bidding on broadband spectrum, but they were only doing it in order to lure other companies in because the way this particular auction worked, the rules were that if you bought the spectrum, you had to make it more open. You couldn't just
right.
control it. You
right.
had to let other people use their equipment on the spectrum, you know, and you couldn't control it. And Google liked that idea. But if no one bid on this auction, if no one met the reserve, then those rules would go away. So Google had to bid high enough for the auction to be official, but then was hoping that someone would bid higher. And after a few tense days, someone did top Google. It was Verizon top Google. But at that point, Larry Page, who's a very ambitious guy, started asking, well, why don't we keep going? Why don't we buy the spectrum? You know, and Google wasn't ready to be a phone company. Everyone said, no, Larry, we can't do that. And they backed down. But I think next time around, they might keep bidding.
Do you think this is in their 5-10-year plan?
Maybe. Or, you know, one interesting possibility would be now that AT&T looks like it might not buy T-Mobile, Google might be interested.
Huh. 1-800-989-8255, which leads us to Cameron in Boonesboro, Maryland's question. Hi, Cameron.
Hi. I love Google. I use it every day, but honestly, I'm scared of it. Every click, every search I make is probably cataloged somewhere and in my file, at least with my ISP. And the other people I work with feel the same way. I mean, as Google grows, will what I search be someday in a court case against me? Will someday
can the government subpoena his Google messages and things?
So this is interesting. I mentioned before how important user behavior was for Google to keep improving the search engine. So they keep that information. And the caller's right, not Cameron's right, not by his name, but by his ISP. They give him a number and say that this number behaves in this way. That information is very important to them. They keep it for 18 months, and they think that that's the minimum they need in order to be really useful there. But they have all sorts of other information about you, which is somewhat siloed. But if you sign in to Google and use that information is accessible to you, and Google also keeps it. And now people are suspicious of Google. When it was a young, feisty startup, people didn't have these fears. But in the years that I was writing, covering it for the book and really immersed in it, it was fascinating to see how the image of Google switched from a David to a Goliath. And now people are worried about this information. And I think they should be concerned.
You think they should?
I think any company, even a well-intentioned company, because as the caller said, what if Google keeps the information safe, but they get a subpoena for it by keeping your information, by letting one company have so much information about you, a legal subpoena can get that information, whereas otherwise it might not be available.
Of course, Google is famous for its motto, "Don't be evil."
That is true. And what I found was fascinating was that a lot of the executives did not shy away from that, even though a lot of people use it as a bludgeon. Every time Google makes a mistake, they all say, "Oh, what happened to Don't Be Evil, Mr. Google? How about that?" But they still think that it was useful as a way internally to say, if this is this, they would talk about an initiative and they'd say, "Well, is that evil?" And it's like the Supreme Court about obscenity. You know it when you see it. And sometimes people would say, "No, I guess we shouldn't do that. It's evil." As you get to be a bigger company, things get a little fuzzier.
Let's go to Bill in Illinois. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question as to whether or not Google helps to reinforce people's political viewpoints. That is, if somebody is a conservative and they consistently visit conservative websites, and then they've developed this history of visiting conservative websites, and then they type in a search term like global warming, will they be more likely to be guided to websites that take a conservative perspective on global warming? And thank you.
Right. Yeah.
So this is what's known as the filter bubble problem. And there's a pretty good book about that recently. Google says, and I imagine they probably have data to prove it, the degree to which personalization gives you search results is not so much that you would be blocked from sites that disagree with you there. And you can turn it off. You could log into Google without any kind of sign in, you could get a clean search without personalization there. And I think you can argue the opposite too. You could say, because Google gives you such a wide range of things, if you are open and you want to learn about different things, it's easier to find things that are opposed to your point of view. If our tendency is to want to read things that we agree with, Google will indulge you on that. But the opposite is true, too.
1-800-999-8255. Google now is involved in an antitrust investigation with the Federal Trade Commission. Correct?
Yes.
What's the problem? They're going to be testifying in Capitol Hill.
Yes. They've asked for either Eric Schmidt or Larry Page, and Eric is going to go and defend Google's practices before a Senate committee there. It's not directly related to the FTC probe, mm-hmm. and the European Union is also investigating them. The problem, there's two problems. There's search and ads. The search problem is that some people complain that Google might give favorable positioning to its own products. And they also say that it's got too much power, that if Google doesn't like you or determines your site is misbehaving, it could give you the death penalty. It could drop you in the standings. And for a lot of companies, where you are on those rankings is life and death. If mm-hmm. people can't see you high in a search, they can't do business. In ads, people complain the formula Google uses isn't a straightforward formula. It's an auction, but the winner of the auction isn't necessarily the advertiser that bids the highest. There's a formula involved that based on, in part, how good Google thinks the ad is. And, you know, the people who are the, you know, the losers in this formula say similarly that, you know, we can't get access to this. So the complainants really are companies that don't do well in Google search or Google ads, and they want oversight. Well, Google's answer is that this is an editorial opinion where we rank things. And actually, a judge actually has ruled earlier, this century, I think in 2003 or 2004, that it is protected opinion where you rank things, like a movie review. Google has to use some opinion, it's the algorithm's opinion, and they make the algorithms on where these things go. They can't give you the web in alphabetical order. So they're saying, if you don't like it, go somewhere else who gives you better search results.
Let's go to Bruce in Danville, California. Hi, Bruce. Bruce.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yahoo invented the original search when they were at Stanford, and then Google took that on. Apple invented the iPhone, which is an object that can also buy cool apps and then use it on the phone, which is pretty much what Android does. And then now with Google Docs, which I love, I'm not sure I should say this, but I love it. They're basically taking on Microsoft's Office suite, which is word processing, Excel spreadsheets, and PowerPoint presentations. And now with Skype and also with Facebook and their own Google Plus, it seems like they're just taking other people's ideas and then just repositioning them in under the Google sort of umbrella. How do they get away with that? I don't think I can launch a Facebook competing app myself and then think I can just exist. So how does Google get away with this?
Well, I think you're right in terms of social. They're pursuing Facebook, and a lot of people in Google had mixed feelings about this. One person told me when they were developing this, they said, this isn't really like Google. Google doesn't chase taillights. Drunks chase taillights. We go ahead. And I would take issue on some of the things you said. Yahoo's search was not an algorithmic search. They curated the web. It was smaller than easier to find interesting things and organize it in that fashion. So the algorithmic way that Google took on the web was innovative and creative. And something like Gmail, it wasn't the first web-based mail, but they were creative in terms of the first to recognize that they can give you more storage and make search an important part of mail. So I think through its history, Google has added innovations to existing products. Microsoft had to follow Google in making its applications web-based. So Microsoft didn't invent applications either.
Mm-hmm. All right, Bruce, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Steve Levy, author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. Do you think you know how Google thinks?
I have a pretty good idea. I spent enough time
drunk
there.
Drunk from the Kool-Aid?
I'm not smart enough to get hired by Google, but then it sunk in after a while.
Yeah, and can you predict where are they going? Because you know how they think.
I can predict sort of the way they'll go there. Exactly where they're going, maybe only Larry knows.
So as you but you don't think Larry, as you say, is going to replace Steve Jobs as the great Silicon Valley thinker?
Well, there's only one Steve Jobs, but I think you'd say there's only one Larry Page too.
Right.
He has some personality traits and some quirks which are uniquely Larry.
If you want to be hired by Google, you're thinking the way that you do, is it better not to go to college? Is it better to be to drop out and have your own ideas and start your own startup company and then they find you?
No. They actually value an elite education. That's something that they're important. When they recruit, they care a lot about what school you go to. And actually, some people in their human relations department, it's called people operations, and very googly, they they say, well, we're missing out on people. But Larry and Sergey had elite educations, and they see the world that way. They ask you your SAT score and your college GPAs, even if you're 40 years old. They ask you that. They say, you know, we said, well, I don't remember what I got in college. Look it up. You know, and Larry Page signs off on every single employee that Google hires to this day.
He does his own interview, or he just signs them?
No, he signs off. They give him a little package with, you know, just the top information. And the way this works is that he can kind of then, you know, like use his mouse and drill down if he sees something he doesn't like. And sometimes he'll say, well, what about this? And bounce something. And
does every employee have open door to Larry Page?
No.
No. Did it used to be there?
It used to be more open. Now, where Larry is, there is actually in the elevator, it says only Googlers with permission can go there.
It says that in the elevator?
Yeah.
And how do you know if you have permission? You get a card?
I think you find out if you don't have permission.
But they did try to do away with the managers you talk about in your book at one point.
Well, Larry's obsessed with making Google work like a smaller company. He doesn't like the concept of middle management. And when the company got to 400 people, he thought, this is too big. We got to do something about it. And he tried to get rid of all the middle managers. They had 100 engineers reporting to one guy. And that didn't work. And, so they drew back from that. But I think that they try to do things which make it feel smaller. They try to keep groups small, and they try to keep the way that decisions are made on a consensus-based means where people can't pull rank because of their seniority, and the decisions are made ideally by data. You can't get rid of politics, but Google tries as much as possible to hire smart people who understand that data should be the basis of the decision, not politics.
Last question. Now with Motorola, is that phone going to have Larry Page's signature on it? Just like Steve Jobs used to check off on everything that came out, that hardware that came out?
He'll watch certain products pretty closely, and he'll watch this, and I'm sure they'll have to do product reviews before we see it released to the public.
How soon do you think we'll see a new Google phone come out?
They try to work pretty quickly. Well, maybe next year. Well, first, actually, it's going to take them a few months at minimum to get that acquisition approved.
Right.
But after that, I think they might move pretty fast.
All right. You should know. Stephen Levy is author of the book In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. Also senior writer at The Wired here in New York. Always a pleasure to have you.
Same here. I really enjoyed it.
We'll have you back later. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to switch gears. When we come back, we're going to talk about, panda poop. There you go. And why it's so interesting and important to the future, maybe, of alternative fuels. Yeah, I got you thinking about it. We'll be talking about it when we get back after the break, so stay with us. Habla Español? Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Well, we're going to bring up a topic that I never thought I'd really talk much about. And, well, we'll get into it. I'll tell you why. You already know how we make biofuels, like ethanol from raw materials like we eat, corn, starch, cane sugar, and how we compete for those things, right? Do you want food? Do you want fuel? Well, that's the easier thing to do, and that's why we do it, because it's easy. But there is a harder thing to do, and the harder to figure out is an economical way to squeeze energy out of tough, woody plant matter full of stringy cellulose, like wood chips and switchgrass and even newspapers, things that we don't eat. My next guests are both looking for the answer in an unusual place, poop. If you think about it, it actually makes a lot of sense. Animals that dine on fibrous things, like animals like pandas and zebras and giraffes, they extract energy from this hard-to-digest stuff. And how do they do it? The secret is hiding in their poop. David Mullen is an associate professor in the Department of Cell and Molecular Biology at Tulane University in New Orleans. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Mullen.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Ashley Brown is an assistant professor in the Department of Biochemistry at the Mississippi State University in Starkville. Welcome to the show, Dr. Brown.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk about this. Why are you looking through animal poop? Why is that a good place to begin to look? Either one of you can jump in if you'd like.
I can tell you why we started looking.
Go ahead.
Years ago, is that we knew they were there.
There you have it. It's like Mount Everest, right?
That's right.
And if there are so many, microbes in the guts of animals, and we know from doing the program that there are lots and lots of different bugs running around in there. How do you single out the ones that you want and know that they use to break down the cellulose?
Yeah, that's really the trick. And it turns out we wanted to look specifically for biofuels producing bacteria, and we developed a very simple method for isolating them, and we now have a pretty good sized collection of different bacteria that produce biofuels. But I think beyond getting them out of poop, one of the interesting things is just to sort them so that you can find those that both make biofuels plus have other really desirable features beyond just making biofuels from cellulose.
I see. Ashley, how did you get the idea to look at panda poop in particular?
Well, I think one of the unique aspects of the giant panda is the fact that its digestive tract itself is the same as any other carnivore. So unlike looking at microbes that come from ruminant animals or animals that have multi-chambered stomachs, the digestive tract of the panda bear is exactly the same as any other bear, and so it lacks any of those adaptations to digest that woody plant material, the bamboo. And so they rely much more heavily on the microbes that reside in their gastrointestinal tract to break that material down.
Mm-hmm. And where do you get your study material, shall I call it that?
We have a partnership with the Memphis Zoo. The Memphis Zoo is about 2 hours, a little over 2 hours from Mississippi State University. And so we collaborate with them, and we get our fecal materials from Lola and Yaya at the Memphis Zoo.
And when you say that pandas are good to study, there are other animals that break down cellulose, but a lot of them are ruminants, right? They have multiple stomachs and things and a large process to go through.
Correct. And so we're looking at some of those maybe minute differences within the bacteria itself that allow them to be able to do this.
And David, you actually turned newspapers into butanol, did you not?
Yes. We've tried all sorts of different types of cellulose, and cotton fibers work great. Paper of different types works great. And so we started, looking at agricultural products like sugarcane bagasse, which is, just the stuff left over after sugarcane has been pressed to remove the, the sugar.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No.
Ashley, can you give us a process of what you do? I mean,
sure. Our process is a little bit different. We're not so much focused on the microbes that would directly produce a gas that could be used as a biofuel or an oil. We're looking to take these cellulitic bacteria from the giant panda and incorporate them into a consortium that would help some of our other bacteria or yeast that produce oil and use that as a platform. So they would aid in these other microbes that would then produce the fuel.
Mm-hmm. So you'd be creating biofuel with their aid?
Correct.
Is it possible to genetically change those once you discover those bacteria and make them better and more efficient at what they do naturally?
Sure. That's one of the things that we're looking at now is we're really going in and trying to figure out all the nuances for those cellulitic enzymes within our panda microbes. And once we have the genes, our idea then would be to genetically engineer or insert those genes into our yeast, into our allogenous microorganisms, so that they would then have those very specific proteins that can help break down the woody material and then make the fuel from it.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, and you can also tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI and go to our Facebook page /SciFry. What kind of possible commercial applications are down the road for this? Let me ask Ashley and David first. Ashley.
I think for us, you know, being from Mississippi with an agricultural state, you know, if we can use this to take plant refuse, leftover agricultural material, and then break it down and then convert it into something useful, I think that that's a really great great focus. You know, one of the most expensive parts of the production of biofuels is the feedstock, and I think that, you know, most of the scientific community is now in agreement that we really need to get away from feedstocks that compete directly with food.
Mm-hmm. And David, is there enough waste cellulose out there to make big quantities of biofuel?
Well, the USDA claims that there's around 1.3 billion tons per year that's produced in the United States. This would be cellulose biomass that's discarded right now. And we've looked into some of the possibilities for, you know, in the case we played with cotton fibers, for example. There's around 2 million tons of, you know, cotton gin waste that's not used for any other purpose. It's normally just, it costs money to dispose of. And so, that's just one possible source of cellulose. And the sugarcane bagasse that's produced near us could probably also be used to convert the cellulose, you know, the cellulose in it into biofuel.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, cellulosic ethanol has always been one of the holy grails of biofuel. You're not going the ethanol route, are you?
So I would picture it happening like this. Within this year, a piece of property is bought next to an oil refinery, and an ethanol plant is constructed. The feedstocks would roll down the Mississippi River, so that the cost of transport would be low. And initially, ethanol would be produced that could be sold directly to the adjacent, you know, refinery. Then, once the federal regulations are in place for butanol, which is what we're interested in, you know, the EPA and local and state sort of, you know, regulatory agencies say that it's okay to begin producing it, then the plant could be retrofitted. It's easy to retrofit ethanol plants to make butanol. Mm-hmm. But once you make butanol, that's a drop-in fuel. It's, you know, you don't have to blend it with gasoline. You can put it directly into a car and then drive away. So we've been focusing on butanol.
And how difficult is it to get from that ethanol to the butanol stage?
There would be different bacterial strains used for producing the ethanol than the butanol, but basically retrofitting an ethanol plant, that's you know, the technology was developed in the 1940s, and it's easy to do.
Could you take Ashley's panda poop bacteria and do that for you?
I mean her poop bacteria are absolutely fascinating. I've been following that story since it first came out. But I'm not exactly sure of the details. You see, what we have been trying to do is what you would call consolidated bioprocessing. So we want to have both steps in one, where you have, you know, the capability of digesting cellulose in combination naturally with the ability to produce butanol. So we have organisms that do that. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, that strains could be engineered. We recently completed the genome of our best strain so that we can look at every single gene in there and begin the process of, you know, shifting them around and playing with them.
Right. So you're just still in the early research stages of playing with your genome there.
We finished analyzing the genome, yeah. And I think these biofuels are really going to be important for the United States. I think it's important for people to move forward rapidly and not, you know, delay. I think, you know, we discovered this bacterium we're working with about a year ago, but I can imagine it being used in industry in less than a year for making butanol.
In less than a year?
Less than a year.
In enough quantities to compete with natural gas?
I don't know about natural gas.
Yeah.
I don't know about natural gas, but you know, without mentioning the names, unless you want me to, there's three big players right now in industry, and you know, they basically popped up, and these are small companies that can produce, you know, 2 million gallons per year just as startups. I think these could be shifted to, you know, much higher production just by, you know, building out the plants. These are just small sort of demonstration plants.
But don't you have all these vested interests working against you? people who are already, you know, invested?
Yeah, so my view of this is that I'll get to work on this for a few more years, and then they'll hand me my hat and show me to the door.
Because you'd
if you're talking about industry.
Yeah, because you'd be a big competitor for them.
Right. I couldn't compete with any sort of industry.
So you're looking for somebody to step in and say, hey, we're going to take over or help you do your project and join us.
I think for those of us that work in science, it could be an advantage to have a useful collaborative connection with an industry, and they could support graduate students maybe or provide some supplies for the lab to work with, and, you know, work could be done at a company as well as at, you know, your laboratory.
Ashley, you think this is all possible?
Yeah, I definitely think it's possible. I think, you know, that you know, some things are very close to the near future of being done, and some of them are a ways off. But I definitely think that, you know, sort of a multiple approach to a common problem is definitely the way to go.
All right. Thank you both, and good luck to you. Ashley Brown, Assistant Professor in the Department of Biochemistry at Mississippi State University in Starkville. David Mullen, Associate Professor in the Department of Cell and Molecular Biology at Tulane University in New Orleans. Have a good weekend.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Up next, Flora Lichtman's here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
And we're into an alternative fuel mold. You got some alternative something else there, right?
Yes. Actually, and it has a biofuel component, but it's really mostly about my favorite beet, which is wastewater processing and remediation.
Is that, yeah, it's your favorite?
I think it's becoming my favorite.
It was mine at one point.
I'm really interested in it right now.
I almost went to graduate school in wastewater engineering because I thought it was really fascinating.
It is, and there are all these different types of solutions. So the one that we looked at in this video this week was, it's in Rockaway, Queens in New York, and the New York City Department of Environmental Protection has installed this sort of prototype system where they're using pond scum to purify water, basically.
Pond scum, that'd be...
I'll be more specific. I know our listeners will want to know exactly. So green algae.
Green algae. Why did you say so?
Yeah. Okay, sorry. So there's this filament. Basically, the way it looks is that there are these two long ramps. They're like kind of like little slides, and they're 350 feet long, and it's all flowing downhill. And they take this water from the sewage treatment plant across the street, pump it over to these slides, and let it go down this bed of mesh, and then algae sort of naturally grows, and then the algae seems to remediate the water in some ways. So basically the algae takes out phosphorus and nitrogen and uses it to grow, and then also the dissolved oxygen content goes up a lot as it goes down this little chute. Mm. And then the water gets pumped, sort of chlorinated, and then pumped back into Jamaica Bay. So this is a very tiny... You know,
sort of demonstration project.
It is a demonstration project, for sure. I mean, that was the thing. New York is such a everything in New York is so big.
Right.
I was surprised. But it is neat because they're actually harvesting the algae for biofuel.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting is that you look at your video. It's up on our video pick of the week site up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. And it's a 300-foot. What I'd call a rain gutter, right?
It's a little low tech, okay.
But it's long. And there's water flowing down, there's algae growing in it, right?
As the DEP person who we spoke with said, gravity works. What can I say?
Make the best use out of it. And this is a serious project to see how, you know, as I was saying, I know aquarists, if you have an aquarium at home, you have something called a refugium. You'll know what I'm talking about if you know what I'm talking about, where you clean the water and they have algae in it.
Yeah, it's the same concept. And I think then the other thing that is neat is they're trying to maximize algae growth, and they actually have these little squeegees to harvest the algae because they're hoping that it could be used for something else. So they made their first little test bottle of biobutanol from this algae, which, you know, it's not that they have one bottle so far, so it's not going to run the plant yet, but that's the idea. Maybe you can turn this wastewater into something useful.
Yeah. Well, you can make a decision for yourself by going over to our website at sciencefriday.com. It's Flora's video pick of the week. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Eric.
And Flora and I will be out at the Maker Faire this week. Come see us. I'll be there tomorrow. Flora will
Sunday.
Be there on Sunday. We have a Science Friday has a booth at Maker Faire at the New York Hall of Science out there in Queens. So we want to see you all there. Come and drop by our booth.
Say hello.
Say hello. And maybe we'll get a little prize or something out there. Drop on by.